This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio.
Stewardess, I think the man sitting next to me is a doctor.
Sir, excuse me, sir. I'm sorry I have to wake you. You a doctor?
That's right.
We have some passengers that are very sick. Could you come take a look at them?
Yes. Yes, of course. You'd better tell the captain. We've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now. Tell the captain I must speak to him.
Certainly.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me. I'm a doctor.
No, I mean, I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
No, I mean, we can't land for another 2 hours.
A scene from the 1980 satirical film hit Airplane and one of the many knee-slapping, belly-laughing, side-stitching scenes in cinema history. Today in Movies on the Radio, we're going to talk about your picks for the scenes that make you laugh till you cry. And joining me, as always, for Movies on the Radio, Laura Boies, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon is here, a film professor at North Carolina State. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
All right, so let's talk about comedy because it is subjective. We talked about the fact that joke, you know, sort of a hospital. What is it? It was a big building. Before the show, we talked about it. You've seen the film several times, and we were all laughing when we heard it again.
Yes, so. A lot of these things have a great deal of repeat value. But one thing that was very interesting when I was asking people about their favorite scenes, people were very anxious to describe them to me, but lots of times the description was not funny. So it really points out how seeing it and experiencing is a lot different than the telling.
Well, and a lot of people also, they go right to that line of dialogue. And so you realize how important, of course, in the sound era, dialogue is to comedy, and really crisp writing and even writing that's recycling, you know, that's like who's on first kind
right.
of dialogue that we just heard. But those kind of plays with language, they really stick in people's mind and they become what gives them access to that funny moment in the film.
And we all confess to loving both highbrow and lowbrow stuff. Slapstick, yeah, who's on first, what's on just snappy byplay that adds up to nothing by the time it's over.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, one of the things that film gives us is the opportunity to kind of escape for a couple of hours, right? That's one way that film works on us. And comedy taps into this kind of release. I mean, if you can go into a theater for 90 minutes and really, really laugh, I mean, you can come out feeling a little bit transformed. And so it's just one of the ways that I think we relate to film.
Which is why a bad comedy makes you so mad,
right?
Because you wanted that release and you were denied it.
Absolutely. I mean, genre is a contract. When you go to see a comedy, if you
true.
Do not laugh, you know, it has absolutely failed in its mission. And it, because precisely as you say, Frank, comedy is so subjective, that's a very hard thing because there's no such thing as a comedy that everyone finds funny.
Well, and you talked about the writing and the power of the writing to kind of make it to sell it all. And yet comedy gets started in the films long before there was any writing, as Bob Pence points out.
I'm Bob Pence. I live in Raleigh. And one of my favorite funny scenes in film history is the ending scene of Sherlock Jr. by Buster Keaton. I definitely recommend, if you haven't seen it, just turn off your radio right now and go watch it. It's a great film, and I will not do it justice. But basically, what happens is he wins over the lady in the course of the film, and now he doesn't know what to do with her, so he's a projectionist in a movie house, and he appeals to the film that's being projected in order to figure out how to behave toward her. So he watches the heroes, the man and woman on the film screen, and imitates him holding her hands, him kissing her hands, him kissing her mouth, and then the film just dissolves to black and then comes back up, and they're sitting there bouncing a couple of babies on their knees, and Buster Keaton just kind of scratches his head and looks perplexed.
There we go. Actually, you can watch the film and listen to the radio, the good thing about Sherlock Jr.
Right. Thank you. I think that's a great suggestion. Well, obviously, the roots of cinematic comedy, particularly those early teen two-reeler films that then evolve into these feature films that people like Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton did, really defined so much of what we think of as comedy. And obviously, without language being key, you could have an intertitle on the screen, but neither of these guys relied on that for their humor, is visual comedy. So expression. Of course, Keaton was known for the great deadpan and elaborate set constructions. I mean, these are the things where the kind of roots of physical slapstick, et cetera, are born.
But it was an international language. Silent films went all over the world because all you had to change was the language of the intertitles. And I had an experience when I was young because my brother collected 8mm films, and he took a copy of Charlie Chaplin's The Immigrant to show to my grandfather. And I never saw him laugh as hard as he did at Charlie Chaplin, because it was funny.
And I still teach that film in my film history to 1940 course at NC State, and the students crack up during The Immigrant. It's like those gags of replacement and substitution, and then combined with Chaplin with all of this pathos and emotion, they still work.
And part of the reason is that visual comedy now seems really different because we're so used to comedies that rely on dialogue that seeing the visual jokes that people make really seem fresh and new.
But those guys, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton for sure, they were taking very old types, slapstick humor and visual comedy. They understood the technology. These guys were way ahead of the time. I thought about The General and a double take that happens in The General where Buster Keaton looks back in the train and you can see the background receding in the background. It happens twice. He does the double take and you're not quite sure what he's looking back at until you realize it's the same background. And apparently he was working on a very, sort of
A limited amount of track that they ran back and forth over the same amount of track.
He's making a joke about his own movie. Hey, isn't that the same background I passed a minute ago? And he's telling the audience, this is a trick.
But he was very meta in a lot of his films, because in Sherlock Jr., there's a scene where he has walked into the screen,
right,
and then there are a number of cuts where he's in a wintry landscape and then he's in a tropical landscape, and it looks like even as the backgrounds change he stays the same. It was a very complicated cinematic trick based on his own expertise at making movies.
Satirizing the film industry in 1926, those guys were ahead of their time. Well, let's move forward a little bit to 1933. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm John Kessel. Scene that I remember of many scenes that are very funny that always makes me laugh out loud is from the Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup, where Groucho is has some secret war plans. He's the president of a country called Fredonia, and Chico and Harpo are spies who are trying to steal these plans. And one night at the mansion of a rich woman who's a benefactor of the government, Groucho's in his nightshirt and nightcap, and Chico and Harpo both get the bright idea of disguising themselves as him. So they independently also put on a nightshirt and a nightcap and paint on a black mustache. So they all look identical to Groucho. There's a number of scenes where there's a confusion of identities, leading to a scene where Harpo crashes into a full-size mirror and breaks it, and there ends up being a space in the room between this room and the one behind it. And Groucho comes looking after the, he hears the noise, and they end up on either side of this doorway, essentially, where Chico decides he'll pretend to be a reflection in the mirror for Groucho. And so they go through a series of antics where Groucho is trying to, it looks peculiar to him, he keeps trying to do something that will indicate whether this really is a mirror or whether there's a person there. And it gets sillier and sillier. It's a scene that little children will laugh at. A five-year-old will laugh at the scene, and I will laugh at it. I'm in my 60s now, just as much as I might have when I was 5 years old.
Well, I mean, what's so interesting about what John has to say about that film is here we're, in a sound context, but it's such a visual gag, and it is incredibly funny. And I like that comment that like a five-year-old can laugh at this, because I mean, that is what's so powerful, I think, about the certainly the silent comedies. And then as we transitioned into the sound era, is that reliance on the visual trick. I mean, it's complicated. I mean, even if you think about the way that both John and Bob described those films, those are complicated stories. Those are not like, here's what happens in one sentence. These are really sophisticated universes. And a lot of the humor you know, is still conveyed through these kind of sight gags that are so delightful.
And this is a routine that has been stolen by so many people. You can still, you know, turn on your TV and see, you know, versions of this all of the time.
Well, and I'm guessing they stole it. I mean, this is
I'm sure it was stolen.
Way back, right?
And
right.
But what was very interesting about the Marx Brothers is even when they were already movie stars, they would take the routines they were going to put in the movies on the road into theaters and see where the laughs were. And then they rewrote and recut and restaged so that by the time it got to the film, it had already been pre-tested and they knew it was funny.
And, you know, comedy, speaking of audiences, as we move into an age where more and more people are watching movies at home and on their own, I mean, there is nothing like seeing a comedy with a big audience where everyone is laughing. It is truly a contagious experience. Things that are not funny on your own somehow take on a patina of humor when you're in a big group of people. And so that is something that as we, you know, move into this world of isolated viewing that I think is going to be lost.
Well, that's what I love about the screenings that I have at the Art Museum is that being in an audience full of people laughing, I showed Ninotchka a few weeks ago with Greta Garbo and Melvin Douglas, and people laughed so hard they drowned out the next line of dialogue. Mm. And that is really an exciting experience when you're going to the movies.
And it might explain why the Marx Brothers slapstick has, for me and for so many audiences, been funny, where a lot of slapstick just isn't. And it's a fine line, hard to define, but certainly it works for them. And so many other comics, it just doesn't.
Well, there was a kind of anarchy to what they did that really spoke to the counterculture generation. So they had their fame, you know, in the 1930s, but then they were rediscovered again in the 1960s and repurposed as a different kind of comedy.
On the State of Things today, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. On the State of Things, talking about your picks for the funniest scenes in cinema. That conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today in Movies on the Radio, we're talking about your picks for the funniest scenes in cinema. I'm joined by film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. And Marcia, you picked Trouble in Paradise. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so what I was thinking about this, I was thinking about the fact that obviously there are, you know, gut-busting, rolling down the aisle comedy scenes. And then there's a kind of gentler, more sophisticated humor. And I went with that. And so this is an Ernst Lubitsch film from 1933, and he was a German emigre known for his kind of wit and elegance and sophistication and also sex in his films. This is a pre-code film, so it gets away with things that films would not in a year or so. And this is a film about class, it's about crime, it's about sex, and the scene I wanted to play is from this what's supposed to be this romantic dinner scene in Italy between Miriam Hopkins and Herbert Marshall, who are both thieves but have been pretending to be kind of aristocracy.
You robbed the gentleman in 253, 5, 7, and 9.
And let me say this with love in my heart. Countess, you are a thief. The wallet of the gentleman in 253, 5, 7, and 9 is in your possession. I knew it very well when you took it out of my pocket.
Sure.
In fact, you tickled me. But your embrace was so sweet.
He's shaking her right now to get the loot out of her dress.
Countess.
Thank you. I like you, Baron.
I'm crazy about you. By the way, your pin.
Thank you, Baron.
Not at all. There's one very good stone in it.
What time is it? It was 5 minutes slow, but I regulated it for you.
I hope you don't mind if I keep your garter.
So, I mean, part of this is the wit of this banter going on and the delivery of these lines by these performers who are playing this as kind of this straight scene with this wonderful edge, and they come together and they're both thieves, and it's also this romance, and it's filled with all of this double entendre and very kind of bawdy implications about, you know, the thievery equating it with their sexual relationship. So this is very typical of Lubitsch.
They called it the Lubitsch touch.
They did call it the Lubitsch touch.
And then came the code, and all those kind of films went out, which brings us to 1944, Laura, and your pick, Lady Eve.
Preston Sturges made a number of extremely funny films in the 1940s. He had very few that he actually wrote and directed, but they are amazing. Miracle at Morgan's Creek, Hail a Conquering Hero, Sullivan's Travels, and The Lady Eve, which, like many of his films, are a mixture of the sort of sophisticated wit, but he was not afraid of the slapstick moment either.
I wonder if my tie's on straight. I certainly upset them, don't I? Now who else is after me? Ah, the lady champion wrestler. Wouldn't she make a houseful? Oh, you don't like her either. Well, what are you going to do about it? Oh, you just can't stand it anymore. You're leaving. These women don't give you a moment's peace, do they? Well, go ahead. Go sulk in your cabin. Go soak your head and see if I care.
I'm very sorry, sir.
So this is Barbara Stanwyck as another con woman who is sizing up Henry Fonda as a very naive heir to a beer fortune who has just come back from his scientific expedition on the Amazon. And she's holding up her compact and watching all of the ladies try to catch his attention until she does it the easy way, which is by sticking out her foot and tripping him.
Yeah, I love that combination of all of that monologue being delivered. And then it ends up in this kind of classic moment of physical comedy, and it works so well. And it's also a reminder how many of these films play with like mistaken identity as the source of comedy. I mean, you get that over and over again, whether it's intentional or accidental.
Well, our next film is one you both agreed had to be part of the show.
Had to be.
Some Like It Hot, 1959. What's so funny?
Well, this is the clip we're going to play is the very last scene in the film. This is Billy Wilder, another German emigre like Lubitsch, and this is a film about two men, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, who have to cross dress and pretend to be women in order to escape death by a gangster squad. And so at the end, this is Joey Brown and Jack Lemmon dressed as a woman on a boat together.
I called Mama. She was so happy she cried. She wants you to have her wedding gown. It's white lace.
Yeah, Osgood, I can't get married in your mother's dress. She and I, we are not built the same way.
We can have it altered.
Yeah, no, you don't. Osgood, I'm going to level with you. We can't get married at all.
Why not?
Well, in the first place, I'm not a natural blonde.
Uh-huh. Doesn't matter.
I smoke. I smoke all the time.
I don't care.
Well, I have a terrible past. For 3 years now, I've been living with a saxophone player.
I forgive you.
I can never have children.
We can adopt some.
But you don't understand, Osgood. I'm a man.
Well, nobody's perfect.
That works. That always works. I'm a man. Nobody's perfect. That's a good line anywhere.
When we talked about movies we could watch 100 times, Some Like It Hot is one of those movies for me. Watching Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon try to manage their feminine attire in their distinctly different ways and then interacting with Marilyn Monroe, who, of course, her sexual persona is a disguise of its own, makes for really delightful viewing.
And this is another mistaken identity film, this one deliberately. And to me, that is the funniest final line of any film ever. I mean, I dare you to come up with a funny line.
And partly it's the expression on his face, though, too. Yes. You know, it's like he's done everything he can. He's just given up.
Yeah. But it's also such a gentle humor. I mean, it's a really kind of perfectly executed moment.
Well, and there was this, I mean, Jack Lemmon, we could do a whole series on Jack Lemmon films and how he was kind of the right actor for the comic actor for the times, mm-hmm. too, wasn't he? I mean, he
Definitely.
Just sort of portrayed that kind of anxiety that...
Well, and we seem to always... I mean, if you chart the big comedy stars of each decade, I mean, it's pretty easy to list the, you know, 2 to 4 big ones that are... And, you know, not many of them have careers that last 20, right. 30, 40 years. It's typically a kind of a moment, and that probably tells us something... you know, about that time.
Well, the stars in that film are also in our next pick from a listener who chose The Great Race. Let's listen.
My name is Doris Siegel, and I live in Pittsburgh. And the movie that I'd like to nominate with the funniest scene is a 1965 Blake Edwards movie called The Great Race. I don't mind admitting that I'm old enough to have seen it in the original when it first came out. Apparently, Blake Edwards was a big fan of silent comedy and slapstick, and most of The Great Race is very, very slapstick, over-the-top acting.
Brandy! Throw more brandy! Throw brandy! More brandy!
The The basic plot is that there is an automobile race from New York to Paris.
Ralph, I never mix my pies. I want to play too.
The scene I'd like to nominate is the pie fight, which is towards the end of the film. The running tension gag throughout this whole thing is that everyone is taking pies on all parts of their bodies. Fruit pies are flying through the air, but the great Leslie walks through the scene in his immaculate white suit, unscathed for most of those 4 minutes, until right at the end when he too takes a well-timed pie. The whole movie reminds me a lot of the Roadrunner cartoons. It's a scene that always cheers me up when I'm blue.
That's the scene from The Great Race, Laura.
Well, it's I'm contemplating as we're listening to these clips that I took this class in Jungian literary criticism when I was in college, and I was told that every plot boils down to two words, the journey. And now I'm realizing that these films boil down to another two words, which is the chase, mm-hmm. which is the comedy version of the journey.
Yeah, and this is ye old pie fight. I mean, how many pie fights right. have there been in film? Right. But, you know, this was a Blake Edwards film who did the Pink Panther right. series with Peter Sellers. I mean, I remember watching that with my family. That was like a big family ritual. We can't wait till the next one comes out. And like, as with comedy performers, there are certain directors that really specialize. I mean, comedy is not something that everyone can pull off. And so those directors that really figure out a way to marry, you know, the kind of the script gestures and language with the visual gestures, you know, they seem to make pretty good runs of it.
Yeah, Blake Edwards, too. I mean, he had a way with a camera and lighting. I mean, he cared a lot about the shadows and the light. And I think that played a big part.
Especially on the pies.
And with a pie. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, a pie fight is a pie fight. It ain't funny. And then something about this pie fight was, and you could spend a lot of time figuring
out. Well, for one thing,
it
was in color. You never saw the color of the pie before.
That's raspberry, isn't it? Well, Laura, your next pick is a Woody Allen film, Take the Money and Run. Remind us about this film and tell us why you love it.
Well, actually, this is not my pick. This is someone else's
pick. I believe it's a listener pick.
It is a listener pick. Let's listen.
My name's Jonathan Kahana. I teach film studies at University of California at Santa Cruz. And my funniest film moment is in Woody Allen's first film as a writer and director, Take the Money and Run, from 1969. And it's a moment where it's the first time we see Woody Allen on screen. He's playing himself as a teenager, playing the cello in a marching band.
When he is 15 years old, amidst the violence and poverty of the slums, Virgil receives a cello as a gift. He is fascinated by the instrument, and for the first time in the Starkwell house, music is heard.
It's hilarious because the cello is not a marching band instrument. You have to sit down to play it. And Virgil Starkwell, the Woody Allen character, is carrying his chair and his cello in this marching band. And he's trying to stop every few seconds and put the chair down and play.
A jungle, however, is no place for a cellist. And Virgil soon learns the facts of life.
And I laugh uproariously every time I see this because it's such an inappropriate visual situation and the insistence of this character on trying to do something impossible and ignoring the fact that he doesn't fit into this group that he clearly wants to be part of. The absurdity and the discrepancy of that is what makes it hilarious.
Well, even in Stardust Memories, one of his later films, Woody Allen bemoans the fact that people always talked about his early funny films, of which this is one. But really, Woody Allen's films, although some people find that his personal life is kind of a barrier to enjoying them, I think he remains hilariously funny in Midnight in Paris, having a conversation with Ernest Hemingway, talking as if he were reading, you know, from a Hemingway novel, I think is uproarious. And in To Rome with Love, there's an episode with Roberto Benigni, who suddenly discovers the paparazzi chasing him for no reason whatsoever. So I think he continues to be really
well. And
wonderful.
One of the things that I think Dr. Kahana was getting at with the Woody Allen is this absurdity that Allen is so good at, and, you know, Marx Brothers are so good at. And that is one strain. I mean, that is one kind of comedy that it has a kind of sophistication at the same time that it has this kind of plainness, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful way of getting audiences to laugh.
And it has thousands of memorable, quotable moments. I mean, you know, that I have a gub, but no, it's a gun.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, they can start the robbery without you. I mean, everybody remembers, you know, scenes and moments from that film.
Yeah, absolutely. And Woody Allen is obviously one of those directors, especially in this period of his career, that is just making these, in this case, it's a mockumentary, but making these films that are so both, you know, intelligent and intellectual, but also so comic.
Our next listener's choice comes from a 1972 film about a mix-up of overnight bags. What's Up, Doc? Is the film.
My name's Karen Hess, and I live in Knightdale, North Carolina. And my favorite movie that's a comedy is called What's Up, Doc? And it starred Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal. And I guess my favorite scene from that movie is right near the beginning of the movie, where Barbara Streisand walks into a hotel and she spies Ryan O'Neal. And I guess she's kind of attracted to him and finds out that his fiance is sending him down to the drugstore.
What's up, Doc?
I beg your pardon.
We've got to stop meeting like this.
I think you're making a mistake. You see, I just came in here for something, for a headache.
You're going to need an awful big glass of water to get that down.
She gets him into all kinds of trouble in the drugstore, and he gets a real good idea about the kind of person she is, which is somebody who's totally different from his fiance.
I'm a musicologist. I was just testing this specimen for inherent tonal quality.
Uh-huh.
I have this theory about early man's musical relationship to igneous rock formations.
Uh-huh.
Oh, but I guess you're not really interested in igneous rock formations.
Not as much as I am in the metamorphic or sedimentary rock categories. I relate primarily to micas, quartz, feldspar.
Well, Peter Bogdanovich modeled this specifically on an earlier movie, Bringing Up Baby. He was a film historian as well as a filmmaker, and he was trying to reproduce the fizz and sparkle of those 1930s.
That's Catherine Hepburn comedies. And Cary Grant in the Howard Hawks film. Such a funny film. But yeah, it's a great reinterpretation.
Igneous rock is good, but I'm still a heavy metal fan. I'm trying to get that in. And that's no schist.
Oh.
That's a geological joke as well. So what?
An NPR geological joke.
That's as close as we're ever going to get on this show. Next listener came. So we're talking about, how did we go this far without talking about this particular film? Well, I guess it's because we're doing it chronologically. Let's listen to this listener and his pick.
My name is Bucky Grimm, and I'm from Mount Airy, Maryland. The funniest moment that I chose in film for me was out of Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks' film comedy/parody from 1974. Fairly early on, there's a scene where Gene Wilder, portraying Dr. Frankenstein, is going to the castle for the first time and meets up with Igor, who is played by Marty Feldman, and who was an obvious hunchback with his affliction of the time.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein. You know, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I'm a rather brilliant surgeon. Perhaps I could help you with that hump.
What hump?
Which is an ongoing running gag for the rest of the film, where the hump keeps changing positions and locations and leads to a long dialogue of comedy business.
Young Frankenstein.
There are so many people who this is like one of their funniest films of all times. And I think what's interesting about Mel Brooks films is that I would consider these one of the divider filmmaker film types, is that people tend to either like love them, can watch them 1,000 times every time, are in tears and have stomach aches, and then there's people who just, there's nothing funny about this. It's crass, it's crude, it's not, you know. So this is one of those interesting cases of, this is such a subjective category of film.
And there are certainly scenes in Young Frankenstein or Frankenstein.
There you go.
The producers as well, that I find to be so completely hilarious. And Young Frankenstein, the putting on the Ritz with the Frankenstein monster is something that never fails to make me laugh. Or in the producers, Gene Wilder having a panic attack and Zero Mostel throws, I'm hysterical and I'm wet. It's just a great moment.
Well, there's a lot of parody of the film industry. Again, this goes back down to Buster Keaton, but Mel Brooks does it extraordinarily well. And there's some sophistication. You sort of have to know what the references are.
Went back to the original equipment that had been in the Frankenstein lab in the 1931 version because Kenneth Strickfalter, whoever it was that built that, kept it in his garage, and Mel Brooks knew this.
Wow.
So young Frankenstein has the original Frankenstein laboratory.
Frankenstein.
And then there is the crass stuff. I mean, I'm going to tell you, in Blazing Saddles, the campfire scene,
Yeah. Makes
me laugh every time. And when Mongo hits the horse, he punches a horse. He punched a horse, and the horse doubled, fell over backwards. That makes me laugh. So he's got all that, again, all that stuff going on, some highbrow, some lowbrow.
Wordplay and slapstick.
Right.
We're talking about movies on the radio today, your funniest moments. Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. We'll talk more funny in the movies when we return. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about movies on the radio featuring scenes that crack you up. Laura Boyes, film curator at the Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, here to talk about them. And our next pick is one that received several votes. Animal House, of course, 1978. Let's listen to this classic line from that film.
Mr. Dorfman.
Hello.
0.2. Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
Yeah. Very disappointing for me to hear that, actually. But it turns out to be good advice all the time. I will be honest with you. And that was a film that, to me, was slapstick that kind of just didn't work.
Not work for me either. And, you know, I'm not a big Belushi fan either. I mean, people loved Belushi. And I remember seeing those films and just not quite getting it. So this is, this is a personal taste thing. This was a huge hit.
Yep.
I mean,
right.
Everyone was talking about this film.
I have friends who adore this movie.
And what do they adore about it?
I think the anarchy is a big part of it.
It felt, that's, I mean, it's good that you say that because there is anarchy and it just felt a little forced to me. I could see it coming. Maybe that was it. Maybe I knew that the plate was going to
pacing, break. Pacing and comedy is also kind of a, not just a taste thing, but it's a cultural moment. I mean, it's very easy to look at comedy films that are, 10 or 20 years old and say, that's too slow. We've got to pick up the pace.
God, the 30s stuff is so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
just
like boom, 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 boom.
It's better to be left behind than to wait for someone to catch up.
I also have, we could do a theme, SNL stars in the movies, because I was a huge Belushi fan on SNL, and I really didn't like many of the SNL stars when they did films. I never got their films.
I think the one big exception to that is Bill Murray, who's turned out to be such a fantastic dramatic actor as well as a comic one.
And I think maybe you put your finger on it. He really is an actor, so he can bring it across in the longer form. And I think some of those other guys were sketch comedians and women, and it just never worked for me. Now, I'm alone in that. Those films did extremely well.
Right.
So all of them did. Well, we talked about mockumentary. I do think Take the Money and Run was a prototype, but Spinal Tap is one that's considered the birther of that movement. Let's listen.
Now, during the Flower People period, who was your drummer?
Stumpy's replacement, Peter James Bond. He also died in mysterious circumstances. We were playing a festival. Jazz blues festival. Where was that?
Blues jazz, really.
Blues jazz festival.
It was in the
Isle of Lucy.
Isle of Lucy.
Jazz blues festival.
And it was tragic, really. He exploded on stage.
Just like that.
He just went up.
He just was like a flash of green light. And that was it. Nothing was left.
Look at his face.
Well, there was.
This truly did happen.
There was a little green globule on his drum seat.
Like a stain, really.
It was more of a stain than a globule, actually.
Dozens of people spontaneously combust each year. It's just not really widely reported yet.
But I did love this movie.
Oh, it's so great. Yeah. And this is a Rob Reiner film, and it's about, a mockumentary about a British band's comeback tour. And it's just a fantastic satire of the music industry. And yet it also has kind of great music and great – it's Christopher Guest and this ensemble cast. It's just wonderful.
And Turn It Up to 11 is part of –
Turn It Up to 11.
Right. Everyone – where did that – maybe people – not everyone knows that came from Spinal Tap, yet it's a complete – completely accepted part of the language.
Everyone knows.
And actually, Christopher Guest's other films, Best in Show, I mean, he's really a hilarious person.
Great stuff. Well, let's. Why don't we run two of these back to back? Because the Coen brothers, of course, would have to place in a film in a program like this. So why don't we take two of their films back to back and take a listen to these?
Hi, my name is Heidi Glenn. I am from Washington, D.C., and my favorite, funniest scene on the big screen is a scene in Raising Arizona where Dot and Glenn, who are friends of the main characters H.I. and Ed Jr., come over to H.I. and Ed's trailer to meet their new adopted baby.
Where's that baby? Where's he at?
Go find him, honey.
Cut it out, Glenn.
He's asleep right now.
Shh. I hope we didn't wake it.
Can I just sneak a peekaloo?
The scene opens up with Dot and Glenn on the doorstep. They have this mess of crazy kids banging with, like, sticks and rocks on H.I.'s car out front.
Get away from Mr. McGunny's car!
H.I. and Ed are completely freaked out of the prospect of being parents to crazy kids.
See, I don't really need another kid, but Dot says he's here getting too big to cuddle. See, that reminds me. Mind you don't cut yourself, Mordecai.
From the beginning to the end, it's just, it's like, there's like a lot of slapstick, but the dialogue is so well written and it's so well delivered that it's like every moment is funny. Every moment in that scene is funny.
This is Alan Booker from Holly Springs, North Carolina. My funniest scene is from the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where the main character, Everett McGill, has an argument with his wife about whether it is better for him to say he's been hit by a train instead of the escaped convict that he actually is.
Daddy!
Hello, sugar!
Huh? How's my little girl? Huh. Who the hell's that?
Starla Warby.
Starla McGill, you mean? How come you never told me about her?
She was hit by a train.
That's another thing. Why are you telling our gals I was hit by a train?
Lots of respectable people been hit by trains. Judge Hobby over in Cookville was hit by a train. What was I supposed to tell him? That you were sent to the penal farm and I divorced you from Shane?
I take your point, but it does put me in a damn awkward position vis-a-vis my progeny.
Vis-a-vis my progeny.
Actually, my very favorite scene in that movie is for some reason one of the convicts thinks that John Turturro has been turned into a frog. Is that right? And they're mouthing across the darkened movie theater. I thought you was a toad.
Very nice. That sounds like an audition to me, Coen Brothers, if you're out there. Well, obviously, the Coen Brothers, among other things, are so good at these dark comedies. I mean, you know, Raising Arizona about stealing a baby and, you know, like just the kind of crazy. They're so good at taking a kind of a realist milieu and turning it into this absurdist, very funny, again, that idea of anarchy, by which I really mean in this case, like, here's something that would happen in the real world, but no, none of this is kind of connected to the real world. And those humdinger lines that, I mean, really great script writing, really great performances by an ensemble cast. And this is something we haven't really talked about explicitly, but, like, you know, John Goodman and, you know, the performers who the Coen brothers use over and over again, that there's a long history of directors working with really talented comedians in particular and using them over and over
that are on their wavelength.
Exactly.
Yeah. And let's not forget The Big Lebowski, which has more quotable lines than any of their other films.
Absolutely. I mean, so many people responded about The Big Lebowski as well. This could have been a whole show on Coen Brothers.
Well, there's another topic.
Yeah. Monday.
It is. Well, and John Goodman but that's a good example because I think in those films, I find him, he's a genius under their direction, the Coen Brothers' direction. Apart from them, genius is not the word I use. And it's television stuff. So it is amazing to me to see what an actor can do with various kinds of direction, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, George Clooney in this film, I mean, is very, very
funny.
He is
fantastic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is, I mean, certainly when you have that chemistry, I think, between you know, a director and a star. I mean, there's lots of different ways that that comes across on the screen. Sometimes it's in a romantic way or dramatic way, but something about the comedy, that sparkle, when it really, really hits, that's pretty magical.
Firing on all cylinders.
Absolutely.
Well, and as crazy as some of the dialogue sounds, it always feels really spontaneous, as though, as though they've forgotten they're making a movie.
You know?
It's like,
and there's always a lot of repetition, you know, and internal things going on in sentences.
And like the joke that recurs over and over again, like the hump and I'm Young Frankenstein. It's so important that that keeps coming back at the perfect moment where you need that extra laugh.
All right, and the Oh Brother, We're Out There, Holly Hunter's always telling about her new husband. He's bona fide.
That's right. And the one that didn't get picked is Fargo, which I think is hilarious, but that doesn't have any boffo big moments. Because it's so dark and so grim, and yet it's wildly funny if you think about just the quarter degree turn.
Yeah, and also that's a film that reminds us of the difference between laughing with characters and laughing at characters. There's a lot of laughing at characters in that film.
Well, sometimes the funniest scene can come in the midst of, as we say, some of the most dramatic and sad and darkest moments. Our next listener choice is an example of that kind of comedy. Let's listen.
My name is Lauren Caddick. I live in Carver, North Carolina. And in Steel Magnolias, Sally Field plays a mom whose daughter dies. After the funeral, she's with her group of friends, and she breaks down and is crying.
Oh, honey, are you okay?
I'm fine! I can jog all the way to Texas and back, but my daughter can't.
It's incredibly sad, but then Olympia Dukakis throws Shirley MacLaine, who plays Weezer, in front of her.
Here, hit this. Go ahead, Malin, slap her.
Are you crazy?
Hit her.
Are you high, Clary?
Everyone that I've talked to who has seen the film just immediately starts laughing amongst their tears.
Malin, you just missed a chance of a lifetime. Half a Chicopin parish and give the eye teeth to take a whack of Weezer.
That's a great example of a film that obviously in that moment it takes this very serious, melodramatic, super female-centric film, sad moment, and then gives the audience this gift of relief. And I mean, in a weird way, that's very lifelike, right? All these moments of sadness mixed with moments of joy and humor. And I think that's, I mean, this was such a popular film when it came out.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about quotable moments. We got a tweet that reminds us that Super Troopers is great because of its quotable moments. Actually, a film I haven't seen, but apparently very quotable. And I'm sure I'm going to hear a lot of quotes. Also, I've just enraged some subset of our audience.
Jim Belushi?
Well, the Jim Belushi fans.
Yeah. John, please.
John Belushi. John Belushi, I'm sorry. A listener has demanded that I apologize for disparaging Animal House. It was an awful movie. I really didn't like it.
Oh, you're going to have to send another tweet, listener.
There it goes. I refuse. I stand on my so. Well, no, it actually was a good movie. I didn't like it at all. Neither did we.
There you go.
Why don't we look at yet another film? And again, acting is such an important part of this. And I think we watch slapstick, we see people fall down, we think it's easy. Oh, no. Let's take a listen to this. Ken MacDonald has a choice he'd like us to hear.
Hi, my name's Ken MacDonald. I'm from Durham. And I think my favorite movie scene, at least the one that made me laugh the most, was in Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. It's the scene where Ricky Bobby comes to see Jean Girard, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, at this luncheon they're having outdoors, and there's Elvis Costello, and there's Mos Def, and all these other cool people, and they go off together.
Do you know why I came to America, Ricky Bobby?
Public schools, healthcare system, giant water parks. I mean, the same reason anyone comes to America.
I came here for you to beat me.
And end up talking about Highlander somehow, and Ricky Bobby, played by Will Ferrell, tells Jean Girard that it won the Oscar for best movie ever made. At that point, I literally fell out of my theater seat to the floor laughing.
So you gonna lose to me on purpose?
No.
No?
No! I will battle you with the entirety of my heart.
And you would probably lose. But maybe, just maybe, you might challenge me. God needs the devil. The Beatles needed the Rolling Stones. Even Diane Sawyer needed Katie Couric. Will you be my Katie Couric?
Wow. I feel like I'm in Highlander.
What's The Highlander?
It's a movie.
Any good?
Very good.
It won the Academy Award.
Oh, for what?
For best movie ever made.
No, it didn't. Anyway, this is, I guess, the sort of subtle, you know, digs at not so subtle always.
Yeah, I mean, so the films that take a comedic approach to some aspect of a culture, in this case of American culture in particular. I mean, you have to kind of know a little bit of the cultural landscape to get these jokes. And so I think one of the interesting things to think about with comedies is what are the inside jokes? I mean, I remember watching comedies, you know, as a kid and laughing at them. And then I saw them 20 years later and I thought, there's no way I got that joke. Why was that funny to me then? I mean, so humor is always evolving as I think we know more about the world.
Well, these more recent comedies are made in a very different way, too, because they rely very much on the improvisational skills of their stars, and there's very little in the way of structured scripting compared to Preston Sturges or Ernst Lubitsch. And then the comedy is made in the editing room. So that's a very different experience of comedy. And for me, there's really a big line of demarcation because I don't find that as funny necessarily as the more polished kinds of comedy.
And you think about, you know, Keaton and Chaplin, going back to where we started. I mean, this was so structured and so rehearsed and so choreographed. And, you know, the building falls and you have to be right on your mark or you die. But, but you know, everything is so carefully mapped out. And there is a rigor and a structure to that kind of comedy. And I think we are in a kind of looser period. And you can see it in the film.
And also, there's such a comedy of humiliation and embarrassment now that has taken a very strong, dominant role in comedy. And I actually don't enjoy going to the movies to be embarrassed. I mean, I don't find body function humor all that amusing. And my husband just sort of randomly asked me, if there is one thing that you could ban from the movies forever, what would that be? And I immediately said flatulence jokes.
Okay, but let me say, The Immigrant has flatulent jokes. Charlie Chaplin, has several flatulence jokes. So that is not new.
Maybe it's the sound that I object to.
Blazing
just saying.
Saddles.
Just saying.
Funniest scene in all cinema history. Hey, Marcia, you're going to a screening that you want to tell us about.
Yeah, so next Thursday, May 21st, at the Colony Theater in Raleigh, we're going to be screening A Fuller Life, which is a documentary about the filmmaker Sam Fuller. And I'm very excited about this. It's 7 p.m. It's $5 entrance. I'm going to do an introduction to it and do a Q&A. I'm writing a book on Fuller that'll be out with Oxford University Press in a year or so. So come on out.
All right. We'll have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. Thank you both.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Sci-fi next time?
Let's do it.
Sounds good.
Science fiction next time. You can check it out. It's tell us about your favorite and big scenes you would like us to talk about. Our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.